The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Hello and welcome. I'm Matthew Goodwin from Washington University, and I'm joined with Dr. Joe Schwab and Dr. Dan Chuba. And we're going to be talking about a couple of things this morning, but mainly about controversies and current issues in the world of spinal tumors. I think to get started, one of the things that we've been talking a lot about here at this meeting is treatment of chordoma, and specifically the role in the role of radiation, both pre and post-op. But more so, there's a large group of people that that treat this disease that are waiting post-op for radiation, and are if they have a good resection and a decent margin, they're following them with imaging. So I think, maybe we can just start, and maybe we can start with you, Dr. Schwab, and get your thoughts on whether that's the wrong thing, everyone should be getting radiated, or where we are with that.
And one of the problems with chordoma, or a lot of things in management of patients generally, is that it becomes about religion, about what you believe in, but there may not be scientific proof of what you're espousing. In our case, we generally believe in preoperative radiation therapy. We do have retrospective data that supports that. In our series, we looked at patients who've had preoperative radiation, en bloc surgery, postoperative radiation, versus patients who had en bloc surgery and postoperative radiation in a non-randomized way, retrospectively. And the patients who had preoperative radiation had better local control. Again, there's selection bias and all the problems that you may have with a retrospective study. But based on that, that really informs how we treat patients. And then over time, there's been some data that for us corroborates that viewpoint. For instance, the data from Japan looking at skin metastases, and the idea that if you're treating the tumor with radiation, and you're also treating the field around the tumor with radiation, theoretically you're going to be targeting those skin metastases. The problem with waiting, in our view, postoperatively, is that if this entity of skin metastases is real, and you've now removed the tumor on block, you've probably left some of those skin metastases where they in the field, but where in the field? The field now has been disrupted, so those skin metastases are anywhere in your field, and I think radiation becomes less effective in that point. But again, this is based on our institutional experience without a real control.
Yeah, so I can't disagree with anything that Dr. Schwab said, and they really do have some of the best experience in this area. What really comes to mind when I'm thinking about this, obviously no one has the answer, and no one has the specific crystal ball, if you will, for predicting it. What we have gleaned from this is if we dissect the heterogeneity of these patients, the ones that have the simple tumors, the one that's a coccygeal tumor, that's, S5 and coccyx, is going to do well surgically, radiation, both, neither, and other ones that are recurrent and they come to you, or they're in theory unresectable, are going to be challenging no matter what you do. And so What I think it comes down to is there has to be more work done on some of these heterogeneous ones. And one way we can do that is potentially, as we talked about recently, is helping to genetically characterize them differently preoperatively. Are there patients who are going to recur more commonly, and can we load up on those more and maybe be more conservative than ones that think are going to be more indolent? And then obviously with Dr. Schwab's comment about looking at pathology and skip lesions, and as we look at circulating DNA and other factors that can predict recurrence or cure, maybe that will make us a little bit more specific, so that maybe the person who has the coccygeal tumor doesn't get pre and post radiation because maybe they don't need it. But maybe the person who says, I think I got most of it in the mobile spine, probably should be more aggressive because it's harder to have those margins. So I agree completely with you that we have to support our religion, but go beyond our religion and actually look at the data. Hopefully some of those technologies, circulating DNA and more genetics, will help to break these into major groups so that we're not treating everybody with the same recipe and make it more individualized.
Great answer. We were just talking in the hallway with Dr. Fisher about the same issue and when to radiate afterwards. And I find it so challenging because in the sacrum, kind of where I am, as I was saying, is if it's a low sacrectomy, and I can get a big nice margin, then maybe I'm waiting and imaging. But if I'm in the spine and I'm doing a spondylectomy and I'm peeling it off the dura, even though it's encapsulated, I feel less good about that. But I think a lot of the data would say the sacral ones are more problematic, right? They're out in the piriformis. And so maybe I have it backwards. Maybe I should be doing it the other way. I think you're pretty aggressive with sacrectomies, or at least you know, we've talked about this before. Do you always take all of the piriformis? Do you not take it if it's a low sacrectomy, or what's your, when you go about deciding your margin here, how are you going about that?
Well, I think, you know, if the piriformis is involved, if the tumor is at the level of the piriformis, so mid-sacrum and above, we tend to look at the imaging very carefully, and we do tend to go, if there does appear to be stranding or some evidence of tumor in the piriformis, we will take the entire piriformis. But I wouldn't say that's routine. It really is a case-by-case basis.
So on that same theme of kind of doing the surgery, doing the resection, you know, the second part of the surgery, as we talked about earlier, is reconstructing, right? This comes up a lot. I know I've talked to you offline about this and deciding what I'm going to do moving forward. But, you know, in terms of implants, metal, carbon fiber, imaging, looking for recurrence, getting in the way of protons, what are you guys doing with implants right now in terms of some of these things and moving to some of these radiolucent implants that maybe are just as strong, or maybe they're not, or maybe we don't know yet?
Yeah, so I think it brings up a point, and just for people who aren't aware, you know, carbon fiber in the cancer setting, the proposed benefits are, one, that the imaging is better to follow the tumor because you don't have the artifact from the metal. And the other one is that for large particle radiation, more costly than, say, photons, so a proton or a carbon ion, that actually the metal may shield the treatment. And so if you have something that's not as shielding, it may help you with your radiation treatment. And that really is what's been proposed. And there are some data to suggest that that's helpful. Again, there's some religion with the radiation oncologist. Some will say, we need it. We need plastic in there instead of metal. And others will say, we can work around it because we worked around it for years. The third thing that I actually find most captivating is when I've spoken with the makers of these devices, they have told me, and I at least anecdotally tried it out for myself, is they say that these rods are unbreakable. And so I took a rod and I tried to break it over my knee, and I just hurt my knee. So maybe that's, but I probably would have done that with titanium or stainless steel as well. I'd probably hurt myself. But the issue is that they say they don't fracture. And so in any construct that we hope to have for a long time, there's going to be strain on that construct unless the area is completely fused. And with these tumors with radiation, that can be very challenging. So in the setting of a failure construct, usually rods break if the construct doesn't heal. And then if you somehow find a way for the rods not to break, well, then it fails at the bone screw interface. So, you know, it is interesting to think about the new dynamic. Is this something that, you know, in a classic defense, in a team, they say we're a defense that bends but doesn't break. You know, we take a hit. So are these new constructs, do they have some bending in them? Do they have some ability to withstand a specific shear and fault lines along the metal? That's an interesting thing. I think the answer is it's not yet proven out, but I'm willing to try it. For those who have tried or are considering to try it, they are not as modular yet. They're still in that infancy compared to metal implants. It's kind of like the electric car. Soon everyone's going to have one, and we're gonna see it's very, very easy, but there's still just a few companies. So you have to get used to it. Maybe you can't bend the rods. The rods have to be pre-made. So there's going to be some trade-offs, as there always is, and hopefully the trade-off is two steps forward, one step back, rather than the opposite. But I think we're all willing to try those because of that. One last thing I'll say about it is that those, I talked about rods and screws, and the other thought would be vertebral body devices. So if you're going to replace a large defect, you're going to have to do something else, because plastic actually, bone growth is almost, you know, is in essence repelled from plastic. And so the bone is not going to grab onto these plastic devices. So you're going to have some adjunct, whether it be an autograft or an allograft, at least to be able to heal bone.
Yeah, that's been our experience. And we've really moved towards purely vascularized reconstructions for anterior column reconstruction. Either at first it was just vascularized fibula grafts. Now we intussuscept the vascularized fibula inside an allograft. And we did that because we felt we had a high rate of non-union. But it also has the added benefit of not causing the issues with postoperative imaging that, say, a metal cage does. So we exclusively use vascularized reconstructions, vascularized rib, vascularized fibula, within an allograft typically.
Both of you have been doing this for a little while and have other things going on, obviously, with your becoming chair, and obviously you've done a whole bunch of new stuff in the last few years. I'm curious to hear from each of you, what do you view as the next big thing in spinal oncology, or what is the thing we need to address most in the next 5 years, 10 years?
In my view, and my hope, is that we are able to move away from ablative surgeries when the ablation is going to cause a significant change to quality of life. I'm talking about sacral tumors where you're removing S2, S3, S4. It would be great, and my hope is that we're going to be able to have some sort of a systemic adjuvant that helps us be a little less aggressive in that setting.
Yeah, I think I would just add to that the in the new role I'm in, where I'm overseeing a larger system, you know, variability is not great, right? And variability is great in life. Variation is the spice of life, as we all say. So I don't mean to say that, but I mean to say that we can't do one thing one day, try the next thing the next day. Oh, we made a mistake. We actually have to start using best practices, whether this be ERAS, whether this be multi-D groups that consistently meet, whether this mean centers of excellence. And this is disruptive, right? Because every person, every center, including myself, wants to be considered free to do whatever we want, that our license gives us, that our training gives us. But at the end of the day, I'm better at some things and more thoughtful on some things than others. And if I'm going to try something new, I should at least be guardrailed a little bit. And so as we work on ERAS and other things, you know, enhanced recovery protocols, I think we're going to see some decreased variation and really pull off those really rare catastrophic failures or complications, because we learn from our own mistakes. We not only like to learn from our own mistakes, I'd like to learn from other people's mistakes and vice versa, so that we have that community sense. It's going to take some work, it's going to take some time, but the patient and the payer and the hospitals are becoming less tolerant of people winging it because they thought they might try something, especially with these really complicated patients. You kind of really have to be part of a bigger team.
Such a great comment. Well, listen, thank you both. Sitting down with two of the real, I'd say, masters of the area nowadays. I know both of you guys are very busy. I've been hanging out with them here, and they're both being called away into different sessions seemingly constantly. So thanks for taking the time to do this.